Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to another Empire Podcast interview special. And this one is a bit special, folks, and a little bit interviewy too. So basically, I went to St. Andrews in Scotland a few weeks ago, and I came away with three things. First, a rekindling of my love of golf. My hotel was right by the old course at St. Andrews, the home of golf. And, well, one thing led to another, and pretty soon my wife and I are playing a lot of golf at the weekends. Secondly, a deep and abiding love of Tunnock's caramel bars, which may be the best thing Scotland has ever given to the world. And they gave us Sean Connery, Kenny Dalglish, and Teenage Fan Club, so that's a pretty high bar. Thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, I came back with an hour-long interview with Joe Russo. In fairness, that's why I was there, to attend the inaugural edition of SANDS, aka the St. Andrews International Film Festival, and talk to Joe Russo, one half of the Russo brothers, of course, the directors of some of the biggest films of all time. Joe was not just attending the festival, but he was supporting it, both financially and with his presence. And so, in this interview, recorded in a hotel room overlooking what felt like the whole of the town of St. Andrews, including the incredible golf courses and the famous and beautiful West Sands Beach where Chariots of Fire was filmed, we talked about his reasons for backing the festival, but we also talked about how he and his brother, Anthony, got their starts in Hollywood, and we did a deeper dive into their early career, including their films Welcome to Collinwood and You, Me and Dupree, and their work in TV on the likes of Arrested Development and Community than we had ever done before on any of our numerous podcast and magazine interviews over the years. And for all you MCU fans out there, like me, there's a little bit of chat about their work on Captain America the Winter Soldier, Captain America Civil War, Avengers Infinity War, and Avengers Endgame, and how they applied the lessons that they learned on their early films and from people like Steven Soderbergh on those behemoths. So why have I waited so long to bring you this interview? Well, simple. The Grey Man, the latest film from the brothers, is the film that adorns this month's issue of Empire Magazine, which is on sale now in all good, evil, and virtual newsagents, and I thought it would be neat to give you a Russo's double whammy. This isn't a Grey Man interview, although we do talk about that film a little bit towards the end. For more info on The Grey Man, plus interviews with Joe Russo, Anthony Russo, their writing chums, Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely, stars Ryan Gosling, Chris Evans and Reggae John Page, pick up the new issue. Go on. Treat yourself. Right. Shameless synergizing and plugging over. Here it is, my near hour-long interview with Joe Russo. If you hear coughing towards the end, it was a member of Joe's team. But don't worry, folks. I'm told they're totally fine now. I think. Anyway, here we go. Do please enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast once again by the wonderful Joe Russo. But this time, Joe, we're not in the offices of Agbo or in a hotel room in London. We are in St. Andrews.
Yes, and if we could translate this view to everyone listening, I think that they would all be as impressed as we are. Right? Yes, this is a very picturesque village.
It's not bad, is it? It's not bad. So we're in a room at the moment overlooking the old course at St. Andrews. But that is not why you're here. You're not here to golf.
No, I am not. Yeah.
You're here because you've essentially willed the St. Andrews International Film Festival, SANDS, into being.
Well, it's I gave this speech yesterday at the festival, where I was just sort of thinking, you know, about what I was going to talk about before I went on stage, and I thought, you know, it's a really long story. Actually, it starts in like 1989 with Soderbergh at the Sundance Film Festival.
I have time for the long version.
Soderbergh being anointed as a sort of regional filmmaker, came out of nowhere. He really, people forget this, like motivated an entire wave in the film business in the 90s, which was this, sort of the micro budget, credit card indie wave that fueled, festivals and the birth of festivals, all over the place. And, you cut to 93 and my brother and I are in Cleveland, Ohio, a million miles away from the film business. And he's in law school. I'm getting an acting degree. He decided he didn't want to be a lawyer. I decided I didn't want to be an actor. And you know, we had the film bug. Mm. Rodriguez made El Mariachi, wrote a book about how you could make a film, right, for $7,000, which really wasn't true because Miramax gave him a lot more money to finish the film and to reshoot parts of the movie. And, you know, but the myth was a motivator.
Kevin Smith also funding,
that's right,
funding Clerks on Clerks, credit cards, $25,000, right, on credit cards.
So it's
cards.
Happening like Brothers McMullen.
Yep.
Right. There is just, you know, filmmakers were getting anointed left and right. And it seemed to be the trend at the time was to, you know, discover voices, regional voices. And then, you know, they're getting these big deals in Hollywood. And so we thought, well, why don't we give it a shot? You know, what's the worst that can happen is we go bankrupt and, you know, we're in our early 20s and then we'll figure it out and, you know, run from debtors for the rest of our lives. We ended up making a micro budget, cut to 97. That micro budget goes to Slam Dance, mm-hmm. which is this upstart festival across from Sundance. Soderbergh was having issues with Sundance at the time. So he brought his new movie Schizopolis over to Slam Dance. Schizopolis was in a lot of ways very similar to our first movie Pieces. Sort of nonlinear, crazy, you know, experimental film. You know, our Pieces was really a very strange movie, but it combined a lot of different genres. I think it speaks to what, you know, we did throughout our careers, playing with genres and smashing things together, and from Arrested Development to Community mm-hmm. to our work with Marvel. And Soderbergh wandered into the screening of the film. You know, 50 people left the theater halfway through, you know, and he loved it. And so then you cut to 2013. My daughter is looking at schools and tells me she's really keen on University of St. Andrews in Scotland. And I thought, that's great. I want to promote my kids becoming global citizens. I'm happy for them to study abroad. I think it's good to get outside of the U.S., get a global perspective. She came here. We fell in love with the school. Then my son came here, and my nephew, then my two nieces. And suddenly, you know, it just became like an institution for the Russo family.
All studying the same thing or different things?
All studying different things. A few of them studying film here because they have a tremendous mm-hmm. Film, you know, critical studies program. Mm-hmm. And it's just gotten better over time. We've done some fundraisers for film studies program and, led to this idea of, you know, this incredible setting. Why not start a film festival here? And so the theme of the festival is beginnings. We're supporting first and second time filmmakers. It's that karmic debt that, you know, my brother and I owe to the universe. We're trying to pay that back by, you know, creating a platform for new voices to be heard and get seen.
Amazing. And it's a hell of a place. And I very much hope there will be a second, third, fourth, and onwards.
We hope so, too. And we'll try to scale it as we go. And I think, you know, Yagbo's supporting it. And,
yeah.
You know, what I love about a university setting is that, you know, you can support a cutting edge approach. And I think as we do try to expand, that we look into new media, I'm interested in areas that maybe other festivals don't support, or something more along the lines of South by Southwest, where you're incorporating elements of all media, you know, but doing it in such a way that is very forward thinking and, you know, looking at like content creators and, you know, trying to find ways to, you know, if you had promoted Bo Burnham 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
When he was a content creator who was, you know, using social media as a tool to reach people, he's turned into one of the most interesting voices in America at the moment, you know, from an artist standpoint, from a media artist standpoint. So I'd love to assist in helping find those voices and giving them a platform.
So are you catching some of the films here? Are you aware of the films? Are you hoping to Soderbergh be Soderbergh for another first-time filmmaker?
Yeah, so what it is, you know, I have links to all the films. I'm watching the films. Everyone at the company's watching the films. You know, we're going to do what we can to support. And, you know, we have a filmmakers collective at AGBO so that, you know, we do this No Sleep Till Film Fest contest where the winner of that, it's a social media contest, becomes part of our filmmakers collective. We give away a scholarship at Slam Dance every year. That individual becomes part of the filmmakers collective, which really is just AGBO. At any point they can call us and we can support them. We can help them find an agent or a manager, look at their scripts, give them notes, you know, give them advice the way that, you know, Soderbergh did to us. Mm-hmm. when we were coming up. So it's a sort of a mentorship program. And similarly, we will find a filmmaker or two here that we, that, you know, sort of lines up with, you know, AGBO in a way that, you know, we can add them to the Filmmakers Collective as well.
So let's go back a little bit, because obviously we've talked a lot, you and I, and Anthony as well, obviously, about your Marvel work over the years, but we haven't really talked so much about the early part of your career.
Right.
By early, I mean pretty much everything pre-Winter Soldier.
Right.
So let's go back to that period where you and Anthony are making pieces. So how indebted do you guys go? How hairy is it?
So, you know, this is, look, we had a strong... you know, vibrant extended family in Cleveland that we enlisted to be in the movie, to help out behind the scenes.
Yeah.
So had a lot of volunteers. We had no idea what to do with the camera. So we started reading some books, you know, sort of self-taught. We were film theory guys. We weren't like guys that were in the backyard with cameras making movies when we were 12 years old. You know, we were guys who were studying film our entire lives. So, you know, we'd watch Apocalypse Now, we're 16 and 17, and then talk about it for days, you know, and then watch it again and stop it and talk and argue about the thematics and, you know, the use of light in it. And so everything was about analysis and film analysis. And, you know, we had a circle of friends who were the same way, and we'd all quote movies to each other endlessly. And, you know, it was a little bit of a Kevin Smith approach, you know. We were doing some experimental comedy at the time at this, you know, our school, Case Western, that we were at. So the first thing Anthony and I ever wrote together was a show that we did. And our heaviest influences at that time were the French New Wave. We loved Truffaut. So we sat down to write a Truffaut movie, like this the more absurdist elements of Truffaut, you know, and we took things that we loved. We were, you know, intertextualists, you know, because of that film theory background. We started smashing genres into each other. It was totally insane, you know, and almost indescribable in how nuts the movie is. And, you know, it had chapters, and every chapter was, you know, it's very, it's a kissing cousin in a lot of ways to Cherry.
I was going to say. Yeah.
So it had chapters in it, and every chapter was something different. And, you know, just moments of German expressionism that smashed into Italian neorealism, and it was all over the place. And, you know, if you've seen Schizopolis, you know, this Soderbergh plays a lead in it, this part where he's masturbating in a bathroom stall, and then he's speaking Chinese halfway through the film, and it's all sort of inexplicably Dada-esque. And Pieces was similarly so. And we loved it. You know, we really enjoyed making it. And I think we prioritize as filmmakers the quality of the experience as much as we prioritize the work, right? Are we being fulfilled by the work that we're doing? Mm-hmm. And what was the experience of making it? And Pieces is something that we just, you know, remember so fondly, even though we're sleeping 4 hours a day, shooting nights for 32 days. And so it was a really unique experience. Mamet was a big influence at the time. Beckett, you know, so a lot of things were pulling into the movie.
These are wild influences, Joe.
They are,
I mean,
yes.
It's fascinating. And there are people who are listening to this going, wow, I want to see this movie.
Yeah.
Here's the rub.
It's something that we've never finished. You know, we put $1 million dollars of music in that film because, again, we had no understanding of the business. So we're like, yeah, somebody will buy the movie and they'll pay for the music. We have Zeppelin in it, you know, it's like, and a lot of the film is cut to the music, you know, it has sort of it's tied to the music. So we thought, once Soderbergh discovered us after Slam Dance, we thought, all right, let's just put it aside for a while and, you know, let's go become filmmakers. Maybe at some point we'll make enough money where we can restore the movie and get it released. And then we just kept pushing it and pushing it. Now we're at this point, we're like, I don't know. Does anybody know where the negative is? Like, but it's okay because, you know, it got us to where we are today. And we have some, you know, it's stored on a computer somewhere, you know.
One day it'll see the light of day?
I think one day. I think we'll just drop it online somewhere.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
We could just drop it online and just walk away and hope that you don't get sued.
That's right. Yes.
That's the basic idea. Yeah. So talk me through those initial conversations with Soderbergh. You said last night, in your introduction to the film festival, that Soderbergh called you guys about a week or so after Slam Dance.
He did. It was very strange because we didn't know he was in the theater.
Okay.
And, you know, we had worked really hard up at Slam Dance. So, you know, that same family came with us. We had 50 Russos running around plastering, you know, telephone poles with posters. And we had a provocative poster. I was a lead in it with a buddy of mine. I'd studied abroad in England and I'd done a play with him and he came over and we did this together. You know, we packed the theater. And halfway through it was unpacked. And then, you know, we left and we didn't feel like we got any traction.
It must've been demoralizing.
It was hugely demoralizing, but in a way, sort of, you know, the thing we've discovered throughout our careers that the things that typically tend to entertain my brother and I don't seem to entertain, you know, larger groups of people. So, you know,
it's quite a statement from the man who's made the two of the biggest films of all time.
Well, it's interesting because I think we, and this is part of the Soderbergh process, right? This all ties back together. He taught us how to become commercial filmmakers. We didn't have it in us. We weren't, it wasn't part of our DNA, right? We were interested in, you know, more extreme, structure choices. We're interested in, you know, there's a bit of like, mischief in everything we do. You know, we tend to make fun of things quite a bit, but it's just the process we have because that's what our daily life is like, is just, you know, throwing out jokes and making each other laugh. And, so it was really, you know, two guys who I think had this very punk rock attitude coming from Cleveland are like, I don't know. We don't give a fuck. They don't like it. Who cares? but he ends up calling and I'm, you know, we're at UCLA student housing. We did it all backwards. We made a movie and then we went to grad school to get a film degree. I was at UCLA. He was at Columbia because we're stealing their equipment to finish the movie, right? And we're using the student loans to pay for the movie, to finish the film.
Okay.
After we shot the movie, we left the negative in a refrigerator in our garage for like a year because we didn't have the money to develop it.
Jesus.
So had there been a blackout, we'd have lost the movie.
That's crazy.
So Soderbergh calls us. My wife is cooking mac and cheese. I'm holding our newborn baby. Hmm. I thought it was... one of my buddies from film school fucking with me. And it's like, this is Steven Soderbergh. And I saw your film. I really loved it. I want to talk to you guys. Can we get some lunch? You know, and I remember at the time, I don't think I said much in response. You know, I think I was like, sure. Yeah, that sounds good. Let's do that.
As soon as you get those calls every day, you just acting blasé. Oh, yeah, Steven Soderbergh.
Well, it was one of those things where I think the whole time I assumed it was a joke.
Okay.
Right? So I was like, I'm not going to entertain this joke. Hung up. And then I got a call from John Fitzgerald, who was running Slam Dance at the time. And he was like, did Soderbergh call you? And I was like, are you kidding me? That was Soderbergh. and so we ended up going to lunch with him at this Cuban restaurant called Versailles on Venice. And we had a fascinating conversation with him that I think changed our careers. He said at this lunch, and remember, Soderbergh was the anointed one. Mm-hmm. Right. He made Sex, Lies, and Videotapes a huge success, inspired, as I said earlier, a new wave of filmmaking. Said something, I think, about Bruckheimer. I think it was in Rolling Stone that got him in a little bit of trouble. I think he said, I'll never make a, I think it was Don Simpson was still alive, but I'll never make a Simpson Bruckheimer movie, you know, and then Simpson and Bruckheimer are completely offended and, you know, blacklisted him. And then he, you know, I think he made Kafka and he made the, there was another one, I'm trying to think.
It was King of the Hill.
King of the Hill.
Yeah.
Right. Both did not do well at the box office. No, right.
That's an understatement.
Yeah. So we're at lunch and I'm sorry, I'm giving the long version.
No. This is what we want.
And he says, we say, what are you doing next? He goes, I'm going to make this, genre movie out of sight at Universal, because he just can't get my movies financed anymore. And we're like completely blown away because this was sort of our idol, right? This is a guy who's doing shit that's as insane and Dada-esque as we were. And, you know, we thought, you know, there was like an endless supply of like independent money to make crazy shit. And you know, here he was like bursting that bubble and saying, no, there's not an endless supply of it. And in fact, you know, it's called show business. I remember the speech he gave us. And he goes, it's a business. If you can't make people money, right, they're going to stop giving you money at a certain point. And so he said, I got to go make this movie, this genre film. It's kind of cool. Elmore Leonard. We're like, well, who's in it? And he goes, George Clooney. And we're like, what do you mean, George Clooney, the TV actor from the hospital show? and he was like, yeah, that guy. And we were like, oh God, we were like, Steven, come on. You're going to like kill your career. This is crazy. You're going to go take this. You're going to take Clooney. Cause at the time you have to remember, George was the star of like 20 failed pilots. Right.
Yeah.
And you know, he had this history, in the business not being successful. And he was great on the show, but you know, nobody knew if he had any range.
He'd
outside
done some
of,
movies
right?
by that point, but they weren't huge hits. Peacemaker and
that's
One Fine
right.
Day, things
yes.
like that.
I think he had done. Maybe he'd done.
Was he Batman by that point?
I can't remember.
Okay.
But I remember there was a moment of like real terror for us, you know, and real concern for him. You know, we were working on this. He said, look, you guys need a script because we got to go out and get a movie made for you. We can't do it without a script. So we sat down, we started working on two films. One was a side project that we'd work on when we, you know, got writer's block on the larger project. The larger project was something called Murray Hill that I'm sure we'll make at some point, which was this a giant gang war set in Cleveland in the 70s around the unions. And it involved a couple of different crime syndicates, okay. you know, at war with each other. And it was a sprawling, really expensive movie. You know, sort of a fairly straight narrative for how experimental pieces was. And then in our spare time, we were working on Welcome to Collinwood, which was a remake of a great Italian comedy. And it was something we just do to make ourselves laugh when we, you know, we dried up with ideas on Murray Hill. So we're working on those two scripts and Soderbergh goes to make Out of Sight. Mm-hmm. We go to visit him on set. We're the sort of, you know, two Goombas sitting in the corner. We look like Teamsters, you know. And I remember people always asking who we were. And we're like, we're Steven's buddies. You know, we'd kind of sit really close to set so we could watch him direct the actors. There's a point, I think, where he started operating or he would sit, you know, he sits right next to the lens. Okay. He watches the performance as the lens, as if he were the lens. So he stays real clear. He doesn't sit behind a monitor.
Yeah.
And then that evolves into this process of just operating. So we're learning a lot from him as he was going through it. You know, I remember going to see the film with my wife when it came out and my jaw hit the floor. And I was like, I think that's his best movie. And it struck us that this filmmaker who had crafted a career, because of his artistic credentials and his individual voice, went to a studio mm-hmm. because he was desperate, and made a movie with an actor that, you know, scared us. Mm. And Clooney delivered an incredible performance. And of course then became George Clooney and Soderbergh delivered his best film. And I thought, wow, we were like the hubris we had to sit there and think, you know, that he was going to destroy his career. It made us think about, you know, our own perception of the business and what we wanted to do in it. And, you know, he then opened Section 8 at Warner Brothers mm-hmm. With Clooney. And, you know, he told Ben Cosgrove, he hired to run Section 8. You know, I started this company to help out guys like the Russo Brothers, help out, you know, younger filmmakers. And so we're going to get one of our films made. So we went and sat on the couch every day at that office in the, again, here are the two Goombas sitting in the lobby of Section 8, you know, with a phone in the corner that was basically because they didn't have an extra office. So we would operate out of their lobby. And we were hustling to try to get people in either Murray Hill or Welcome to Collinwood. We were going to see which one we could get off the ground first. And we watched him and Clooney, make the Oceans movies, right? But then we also watched Steven make Traffic. And we saw this trajectory to his career, which was one for you, one for them. Mm-hmm. And he was using his commercial capital, which he learned to do on Out of Sight, to finance the crazier ideas that he had. And I remember all the wisdom that we got from he and Clooney over the years as they would come in that office every day and find us in the corner and they'd sit down and, you know, give us speeches about, you know, one for you, one for them, or have a list. You know, if someone's an asshole, they go on the list and they never come off it, never work with that person. And, you know, they're very particular about, you know, their rules and about passing along information to us and guidance and experience to us. And that's how, you know, just that period from that lunch at Versailles through those next 5 years is really how our brain started to understand the business of making movies.
So when you look back, for example, that idea of one for you, one for them, which you hear people will say some from time to time is about, you know, making big movies like Infinity War and Endgame. Obviously, you and Anthony made four of those movies in a row. Do you see those as building up a cachet so you can make things like Cherry ultimately down the line? Or were they, how much of those movies were for you and how much of them were those movies were for them?
So we started, we were fortunate enough to have the experience of watching what Steven and George did with Section 8.
Yeah.
And if you go look at the roster of people who went through there, it's pretty impressive, the people that they helped out. But I remember Steven getting burned out and going like, this is too much work to produce, you know, and they shut the company down. He left and, you know, he was like, I just want to focus on my movies. And then he started going back to much more personal filmmaking, which he's been doing, you know, for a while now. And I remember having a conversation with him in the 2010s, early 2010s saying, you know, because we were in television at the time. And I said, look, man, it's the new indie filmmaking is in TV, you know, you get a lot more money to do it, you know, and you get a lot more support and you can get, so you can tell, and you can tell your stories for longer, you know, so you can really invest in the characters. And then he did his show. So I felt like, you know, we were starting to like feed each other information over the years about how we were seeing the business. And Anthony and I, just to give you our trajectory, to tell you how we got to Marvel and what Marvel meant to us.
Of course.
Right. We got a pilot. We made Welcome to Collinwood instead of Murray Hill. Because I remember at the time that Steven, you know, was like, we got to get it started, play the lead in Murray Hill. And, you know, it was centered around an Italian kid from a neighbor that we grew up in. And he was pitching guys who were in Italian. And we're like, well, we can't, it's not really authentic. We can't really ask somebody to pretend like they're Italian. We're going to get like a really, you know, shitty sort of commercial interpretation of who this character is. And he was like, all right, fine, whatever. Let's do the comedy, you know?
Yeah.
We made the comedy. Comedy didn't make any money, right? It made negative money at the box office. But we were lucky enough to get a show called Lucky at the time that we shot in a very verite style, reflective of Man Bites Dog, which is a film we loved out of Cannes Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And that led to Arrested Development. So suddenly our sort of independent genes were valuable in the TV space because, as I said, in the 1990s, independent film was thriving. But in the early 2000s, when The Sopranos was made and shows started to become more cinematic and have more challenging thematics and deeper characters and more interesting material, all those indie filmmakers started gravitating towards TV because that sensibility was working in that space. So we started getting calls from the TV space. So we made Lucky, which was a really dark, twisted show about a degenerate gambler in Vegas. It was high comedy, but it was also like his wife died from a drug overdose. And the pilot ends with him giving back the engagement ring to his dead wife's parents to as a way to pay them back for money he'd stole from them. So it was really nuts pilot just from a tonal standpoint. And that led to Arrested Development, which led to Community, and sort of we became guys who had very potent juice in television where we could control creatively the shows that we were working on. We didn't make anybody any money, by the way. You know, Arrested Development didn't make any money until many years later. Lucky didn't make any money. In fact, I canceled after one season.
Yeah.
And Community really didn't make any money until years later when, you know, digital distributors started buying these older shows and, you know, putting them on their platform in order to get some eyeballs, you know, get some content.
Still never quite got six seasons in a movie, though. We didn't get the movie part.
I think we might get that movie at some point. I don't know.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
But so we started looking at the business in a different way, because we were becoming these ubiquitous producers in television. I think we directed 10 or 11 pilots over a certain period of time, put 10 of them on the air. I remember at one point we had 3 shows on the Paramount lot. We had 7 stages. You know, we basically owned half the Paramount lot for these shows we were working on. We started developing a post process that could incorporate all these shows. It was, you know, digital, where we could work out of the same space to post the shows and literally hit a button and send them to all the affiliates to get them on the air. So we were thinking, and more of now like a, you know, mega producer kind of mindset. Like, how do we, because I think we have high functioning ADHD and we like to work on a lot of projects at the same time. We like to express ourselves in different ways. We get bored fairly quickly with one sort of tone. Mm. And so we started looking at that as like what the power it was giving us working on those shows was infectious, because it allowed us to make decisions without compromise on the business side, because I think our brains were starting to understand, you know, like how to deliver things in a way that they would suck up pop culture oxygen like Arrested Development or Community,
yeah,
which made them harder to cancel even though they weren't, you know, highly commercial.
Yeah.
Right. And it was always our dream then to build our own studio. And when we got the Marvel opportunity, we saw that as a potential to leverage, you know, these big commercial plays into raising capital to start our own studio, so that at the end of the day, we could just really be our own bosses. And that's the track we took. So even though we did 4 for them, and I don't say that, I say that in jest, because we loved making those movies, absolutely loved making them. We love those films, but it led us to a very particular place. Because one of the lessons we learned, sorry, last thing I'll say, is Soderbergh famously ended up kind of walking away from the business because he was so pissed off.
Yeah,
he had a really shitty experience with Sony, and threw up his hands on a film and said, "Fuck it, I'm not working with studios anymore." And so we thought, can we get to a place where we have enough leverage where we don't have that problem, you know, moving forward? And so again, everything that we've done in our careers has come from Steven in some way, or learning from Steven in some way.
There's a lot to dig into there with that. Let's go back, first of all, to Welcome to Collinwood, because that is a movie that, as you say, was produced by Steven. George Clooney was on there as producer,
right,
as well.
And he took a role in it to help us get it made.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm just fascinated by the fact, you know, you guys made pieces for, well, pieces and just, you know, put it together with some sticky tape and whatever was knocking around at the time.
Yeah.
Then you find yourself in Welcome to Collinwood with a crew, actors, known actors, name actors for the first time. George Clooney's there, William H. Macy's there, Sam Rockwell, Michael Cheater, amazing, amazing actors. What does that do to you guys? How did you cope with that transition?
Well, so Pieces was literally a crew of like 6-7 people working together every night, right? We would do our own makeup, you know, we had no playback, obviously, right? So the DP that we had found was a great guy named Dave Litz, who was like the only guy in Cleveland who knew how to operate a camera and, you know, was doing some, you know, commercials and things like that. So you had to trust Litz. We go, did we get it? And you go, we got it, you know, and we didn't see anything until like a year later, you know? So we just had to keep our fingers crossed that we got what we needed in the can. And so when we got to Collinwood, yes, it was very different. It was hard to get that movie made. Again, weird film, not like a, you know, a highly accessible movie. And I'm shocked that George and Steven promoted it to get made through Warner Brothers. Because it was not a film that, you know, should have been released on more than like 20 screens, you know? And so it was really an experiment to see if they could get the kinds of movies that they liked made through the Warner Brothers system.
Yeah.
I do remember the first day we showed up on set, Anthony and I drove together. And as we started to approach the set, we got really nervous because there were trucks everywhere. And we thought, what the fuck is going on here? We have to shoot here today. And there's clearly some sort of, you know, event going on with all these trucks. And, you know, we got out and we started to realize this was our crew and they were setting up, you know, for the day. And the scale of it was disconcerting to us because, you know, we were used to sort of controlling everything because we were putting up the lights ourselves and the C-stands and cooking, you know, lunch for everybody every day. I mean, it was like, you know, to suddenly have that taken out of your hands and learning how to collaborate with not just an extended group of people, but hundreds of people.
Yeah.
That was a real lesson for us in that movie. And we had sort of very rigid rules about how we wanted to execute the movie. We wanted it to look like a Bowery Boys film because we loved the Bowery Boys growing up. So everything had to be done studio mode, you know, and in a style of, you know, a 30s film. It couldn't, yeah. You know, so we're following all the rules. I think we used a Steadicam once. We cheated for a walk and talk. But, you know, we were really militant in our prescription of how we wanted it executed and learned a ton, you know. And again, you know, Steven pulled about $8 million out of Warner Brothers to make this movie. The movie should have been made for $2 million. And so we learned that, you know, if you make a film that doesn't work in a studio system and it doesn't work for the people who are giving you the money, and you're trying to jam a square peg in a round hole, you're probably not going to have a good experience. And so again, that was a real lesson for us.
How do you then communicate to your crew, you know, that it's okay, guys, we know what we're doing? Because, you know, I've been lucky enough. I mean, obviously, you know, there's many years between Collingwood and Infinity War, but I was lucky enough to be on set, you know, watching you guys direct on Infinity War. And there, it was such a smooth process, mm-hmm. just watching you guys direct this huge behemoth of a film. So how did you do that? How did you convince the crew in Collingwood that it's okay, trust us, we know what we're doing?
Well, we have two advantages, I think. We had two advantages at the time. One was because we're a directing duo, we collaborate on a daily basis, which means that we have to talk through our ideas with each other, that the ideas get vetted by one another. Mm-hmm. We have a pretty fierce process. I mean, you see the two of us on set sometimes. We're arguing like two Italian guys would argue on a street corner, right? So people like back up, you know. Are you guys okay? Yeah, we're fine. Just give us 5 minutes. This will get hashed out. So that's part of our process. So we're used to communicating because we have to. Not only do we have to communicate, but sometimes we communicate in a way that, like, you know, a high school debate club will communicate because we fight with each other so much about our ideas that, you know, it becomes about who's wittier or who can make their point more clearly.
So you and Anthony rap battling, is that?
We do. And so it's this, you know, there's a process there that we're unafraid of conversation. We have to be. The second thing we have going for us is we come from a really big Italian family. Mm-hmm. So we're used to sort of the, you know, the politics of a large unit, you know, large community. And so we're able to translate those skills into working with a crew. Because really, at the end of the day, I tell young directors this all the time. Directing is truly about communication, and it's about making decisions. If you do those two things well and efficiently and under pressure, you can direct. Because when you take the practical elements, you do all that work in a room of writing a script. Take the Coens, for example, right? 90% of the work they do is done in a room before they get to set. Mm-hmm. Where I think the two of them probably, their process is incredibly mysterious. So I'm just guessing here. But my assumption is the two of them in a room talk through. They have a very disciplined process because they work a lot. They write a lot of scripts. My assumption is they sit in a room and they hash these things out on a granular level of detail. And then, you know, just anecdotally, the stories that they've heard on set is that they're pretty clear about what they want based on what the script is, mm-hmm. you know? And then when they get an editorial, they edit it. So it's all, you know, under their control from start to finish. You know, their decisions are made, in the room, you know? And then I think made again, at the end. I've heard that they're open to ideas, but they're usually, you know, if it's not better than their idea, it's not going to be in the movie, you know? And it's hard to come up with an idea that's better than their idea.
this is true.
So, you know, so our process was communication. And I think we just started fudging our way through it a little bit. Yeah, you get George Clooney on set and you're like, oh my God, how do we? I had some experience as an actor, so I knew how to talk to actors. I could talk about beats. you know? And we make a lot of jokes on set because we like to keep it loose.
Yeah.
You know, you want to keep, it's hard work. People are working 12, 13, 14 hours. So you want to keep them invested in a way. And if they're having fun and they feel connection to you, they feel warmth, they'll work harder, you know, and we'll all work harder for each other because we care. So we just started using humor and we started, you know, using our infectious energy to drive everyone through it. We learned a ton. I think we made a lot of mistakes on that movie, but mistakes that we love. And like, you know, you learn more from your failures than you do from your successes. And that's absolutely true.
That certainly seems to be something that plays into, you know, the work you guys did for Marvel, where you have forged these wonderful relationships with people that you've worked again with. Obviously, you know, Chadwick, you know, God rest him, and Chris Hemsworth. You're doing a couple of films with Chris Hemsworth, Tom Holland, Chris Evans, you're back again. You know, so was that something that...
work with Zoe on another movie, yeah.
So presumably that's something that you were...
Yeah.
Almost consciously doing, forging these relationships with actors?
No, I just think that, okay, so we... TV was really valuable to us as filmmakers. It's another adage I give to young filmmakers. I say, look, if you want to be a carpenter, you got to make a lot of tables.
Yeah.
You want to be a good filmmaker, you better go out and shoot.
10,000 hours.
Yes, that's it. Now, where kids today have an advantage is they're already putting in those 10,000 hours on TikTok. You know, they understand storytelling in 30 seconds or a minute. They understand framing, you know, content creators or self-generators. You know, they're going to film school on their own and they're doing it from the time they're, you know, 10 years old. So there's an instinctual skill set that they have. So there's sort of an instinctual skill set that they have. For us, you know, I think that that work we did in television, there was so much volume we were doing and it was all so different. We were doing half hour comedies, hour-long dramas. Shooting styles were different on all of them. We're using, the first guys used digital cameras on a narrative television show with Arrested Development. So we were experimenting with technology. We created this whole, as I said, this whole post-process that allowed us to just, you know, literally shoot on the stage, get in a golf cart, go two buildings down, walk into our post facility, edit, sound design, music, mix, and hit a button and send it all out from the same location. So it was just so much volume happening that, you know, we're becoming, you know, really adept at the process of making content. And we liked having relationships where we had a shorthand with people. It made the work more efficient. It made the work easier. And you tend, like anything in work, you identify people that you connect to, that you can have fun with, that, you know, that we could tell jokes with, and they would entertain us and we would entertain them. So the in-between time was filled with, you know, quality of life moments. That's why we returned to, you know, a lot of the same actors over and over again. It's that shorthand. We want to see them. They're our friends. We want to hang out with them. We want to spend 5 months together. That experience we had making Cherry with Tom Holland is like some of the, you know, the best 6 months any of us have ever had together. We had an absolute blast. And again, we value that. It's really important to us. So that's why we work with the same actors over and over.
When you move into TV after You, Me, and Dupree, which I don't know if that was a good experience for you or not.
I mean, it was not a great experience. Again, learning more from your failures than you do from your successes. That was one that I think that Anth and I felt like we were sixth in line for control on that movie, you know? And it was somewhere after the composer, you know, like that's the level of control we felt that we had on that. And it was it was weird because we were in credit card debt from Pieces for quite a long time. You know, we ended up carrying like $60,000 in credit card debt for a while. And even though we were working in film, we were sort of splitting our fees. We were splitting our fees. On Collinwood, we gave back all the money that we made on that movie to pay for two extra days because we were pissed at the, these are all hard lessons you learn. But we didn't make a dime on Welcome to Collinwood, zero money. So we're again, living off our student loans. We were pretending like we're still going to film school while we're making the movie.
Jesus.
And so we were carrying all this debt. And we got an opportunity. Somebody called and said, do you guys want to do a commercial comedy? And we thought, well, we're doing so much comedy and TV, we'd won an Emmy for Arrested Development. This might be the only kind of offers we get on the feature side. We were more than happy in the TV space because, like I said, we worked ourselves into a position where we had an incredible amount of control, and
yeah,
we can get projects greenlit, we can get them put on the air, and we loved who we were working with. I mean, you know, Community was an absolute blast outside of Chevy Chase. And so...
Well, there's a separate podcast right there, yes. I think.
So we're in this position where we get this phone call from Universal about this project, and Owen Wilson's involved. It was just coming off of... he was just coming off of... what was the movie with him and Vince?
Wedding Crashers,
yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And we're like, okay, great, but we want Mitch Hurwitz from Arrested Development to rewrite the script. You know, and the writer who we love, but there was a writer on the Owen project who was really close with Owen, great guy. I remember we were pushing to get Mitch, and, you know, we're like 6 weeks out and they kept saying, yes, yes, we're going to get you Mitch. Don't worry, we're going to get you Mitch. And then 5 weeks out, we're like, wait, where's Mitch? And, you know, it was just, they steamrolled us, you know, into a process. And I remember thinking, oh, so this is how it works. You know, like we're not, you know, we don't have that level of control that we have in television. And we made the film, and the film did what it did. I mean, it actually was the first thing I think we ever did that actually made money. Cause every show we ever made, you know, if it was critically acclaimed, it was off the air in 2 or 3 years. Community had such a strange existence, you know, yeah,
bizarre
with Harmon, without Harmon, canceled, uncanceled, you know, same thing with Arrested, right? Canceled after 3 seasons and then comes back on Netflix years later. So everything we had made had some sort of messy financial existence. The movie made money, but it was not a great experience for us. And, you know, I typically don't like to talk about these things because it's not, you know, I do it because I think it helps to educate people. But I'm not here to shit talk, and I'm not here to say,
of
like,
course, yeah,
we're responsible for whatever choices we make in our life. We're responsible for the work that we do. But it was a hard lesson that we learned about how studios work versus how television works. And it was another lesson after Collinwood that we learned about don't make content that a studio doesn't want to produce because you're going to square peg round hole it. Second hard lesson we learned was, you know, you have to be in control, and understand you're in control and get the things that you're asking for before you commit, or they're going to steamroll you. And so weirdly, when we went to that first meeting with Marvel, cause we were like, we're not making movies. Why would we do that? We're in television. We're having fun. We love.
Had you been pitching on big projects, big movies during that time?
You know,
in
it
TV?
Was only, so again, it was only comedy that people wanted us for.
Yeah.
And I think part of the reason comedies don't work today in theaters is because it's the most predictive model of storytelling. And I think theatrical has for a while subconsciously been moving towards eventized films because it's expensive. You have to remember, like, it's hard for people, especially people outside the US, UK, to go to the theater. It costs a lot of money. When you can watch 40, you know, stories on Netflix or one for equivalent price, you know, you're probably going to choose the 40. So when we go in for Marvel, Feige, who's a genius, had watched the paintball episodes of Community, right? Community was just an exercise in genre. That's really what the show was, right? Dan is a fascinating guy. We had a really interesting, complex relationship, the three of us, me, my brother, and Dan. And I'm sure Dan will tell you stories at some point about, you know, I mean, that show was crazy. But we explored what we could do with that ensemble for about 12 episodes. And then we went, well, fuck, are we going to, like, do we have to do this for 5 years? Like, where's the storytelling going to go? Is every episode going to be about there's a problem? And then, you know, the problem gets resolved in 22 minutes. And I think we're all restless with the format. Mm. And that's when, and it was Dan who said, why don't we start using genres, different genres, and putting this applique on top of the show to create a more unique show? And as filmmakers, we love that because, again, we're students of film, gives us an opportunity every week to play around. And so every week became a different exercise in filmmaking. Feige loved that. He watched those paintball episodes and went, I think these guys understand action storytelling, but I love that they can do humor too. And that's the secret sauce of Marvel, right? Is that, you know, it has humor and heart and emotion and spectacle, but it has humor. You know, you're hard pressed to find a Marvel movie that doesn't have humor in it somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And we went in the room to pitch on it, but we were comfortable enough with where we were in TV at the time that we're pretty adamant about our vision. We're adamant about executing that vision. And we're adamant about having control because we're like, look, we produce TV constantly. So we're a little bit of a machine, you know, and we know how to execute efficiently. And we went through a process. There's a lot of filmmakers fighting for the movie. Our pitch was to turn everything on its head and, you know, sort of throw out what they had done on the first film in a weird way. You know, let's go postmodern with it. And when we got the job, they were true to their word and that they gave us a lot of room. And they did for every project we did for them. So it was a completely different experience that we'd had in the past. But Kevin, again, is a great collaborator. And very trusting. Like, if you win his trust, you know, you can do whatever you want. You know, he'll support you. He'll support your crazy ideas. He'll support, you know, taking his two lead characters and having them try to kill each other. He'll support you killing half his characters. He'll support you killing Iron Man, you know. And so we had a fantastic time working with them because, you know, we had a great level of control. Again, we're not afraid of collaboration. So all Kevin ultimately cares about is, can he come in a room with you and hang out? And he's amazing at pitches, like, and pitch on what you're working on. Mm-hmm. So he had us and my brother and Marcus McFeely and Kevin, and he would come in every 2 or 3 weeks and he'd just sit for the day. And, you know, we talk about where we're at, you know, because we have a very disciplined process of developing, screenplays. That's really what AGBO is me, Anth, Marcus McFeely, taking all the work we'd done, the codified process we had created working with Marvel and translating it to our own studio. And, you know, we'd start with a 3-page outline and that would take months because we'd all argue about what the story is. And then Kevin would come in and he'd argue about it with us and we'd throw out ideas. And Nate Moore was a huge collaborator, was a executive at Marvel. And then we'd go to a 10 to 20 page outline and then, you know, we'd do the same thing and Kevin would pop in and read where we're at. We'd all talk about it. Everybody fight about it. Then we'd do some more work and then he'd come back in. And then when you go off to make the movie, they're very hands off, you know, it's sort of it's your bed to make in a lot of ways. and Marvel really is sort of where those famous stories come from about, you know, people getting put on the sidelines or, you know, them coming in and post. It's really about how you deliver your director's cut. Cause you know, filmmaking, you get prescribed a window in which the director gets a cut and then the producer comes in and the producer becomes part of the process with you. Where I've seen issues is when a director's cut gets delivered and it's not what they were expecting or it's not working. Then, you know, Marvel turns it on and, they come in and start to work with the filmmaker in a much heavier way to develop fixes for the movie. And then they go into extensive reshoots and, you know, but part of our process, Anthony and I, was that we tend to reshoot while we're shooting because we will go into editorial at night. You know, we're exhausted. We're sleeping 3 hours a night, but we're watching what we're shooting and we're assessing it. And if there's a problem, we're fixing it the next day before we tear the set down. We go get a close up or we rewrite the end of a scene with Marcus McFeely or we, you know, whatever it is, we address it so that our director's cuts were really comprehensive and really polished. And that's really was the process at Marvel.
Yeah. The number of times I've spoken to people who've worked on Marvel movies where they've said that Kevin will come in and be sitting in pitch meetings and story meetings and then just out of nowhere he'll drop a bomb. He'll go, why don't we have all the Spider-Man villains in this movie? And suddenly he's like, oh wow. So he'll just sit there quietly and just boom.
Yeah, he's amazing. Like his brain is amazing. His sensibility for commercial material is incredible. Anthony and I learned very early on that when we watched, so you do a screening with Kevin, right? He'd sit and watch your director's cut with you. And if you look over at him, and he's leaning forward, you know the movie's going to work. And when he's leaning backwards, you know, like just from a test audience standpoint, like he can sense exactly where that movie isn't going to connect with an audience. And it's innate. It's inside of him because he loves storytelling so much. And that was always a great litmus test for us because we'd kind of side-eye Kevin just to see whether he was leaning backwards or forwards while he was watching the film.
Amazing. So two real quick questions, Joe.
Yeah.
I cannot forgive myself if I didn't ask about Extraction 2 and The Gray Man.
Yeah.
Where are we with both those movies and what else you guys got on your slate?
So Extraction 2 just wrapped. I just came from Prague. I was there with Sam Hargrave and Hemsworth for a couple of weeks. It's certainly scaled up from the first movie. It was interesting going on the ride to discover what that franchise was, because initially I had envisioned, you know, killing him and going backwards for storytelling purposes. I thought it'd be interesting to tell a franchise in reverse, you know, but the practical execution of that is because, you know, Hemsworth isn't aging in reverse.
he's so far off, but yeah.
Yeah. By the way,
yeah.
Is anybody on the planet that has a shot at aging in reverse? It's him.
Yeah.
But it just felt like it was going to be more complicated than was necessary for a franchise. So we ended up going forward with it. But really, really excited about where it's headed. And Gray Man might be my favorite film that Anthony and I have made, because it, you know, action is, really close to our hearts. We grew up watching action films with our dad. He loved them. We'd watch The Late Show with him, French Connection. It was a huge influence on us. And I feel like there's a really nice blend in this movie between action that we love, our humor, and our quirkiness. And I think it's sort of all wrapped up in there in a way that, and you know, tone is the hardest thing to manage as a filmmaker. If a movie doesn't work, it's because the tone is either poorly executed or it's inconsistent in a way that is illogical, right? And your brain can't track it. So the things we get most excited about are tonal experimentation. And you know, you're like a mad scientist going into the laboratory and you're hoping you don't blow yourself up because you're mixing, you know, beakers of chemicals in a way that could be disastrous. You know, you could wind up with something that is not good. And I'm really excited about this one because I think it it works on a lot of levels. Obviously, we'll see how the audience responds to it. But for us as filmmakers, we're very satisfied with it. Very happy.
Amazing. Well, I can't wait to see both of those films. In my review of Extraction, I noted that Tyler Rake at one point fights someone with a rake.
That's right.
In a triumph of nominative determinism. Yeah. And I posited the idea that he might fight a character called Keith Dildo in the sequel.
That's right.
Joe, can you confirm or deny whether there is a character called Keith Dildo in Extraction 2?
There is not a Keith Dildo in Extraction 2. But you know what's interesting is that Anth and I, over the years, have made fun of movies as much as we've enjoyed them. And so there's, you know, like I said earlier, there's always a bit of mischief, in our filmmaking. And, I remember the two of us sitting around talking about what we're going to name that character from Extraction. and we have to amuse ourselves as much as we have to sort of honor the movies that we grew up on. And we were like, you know, I think we went through like three or four gardening tools before we settled on Rake.
Hoe, spade,
as the last name for
shovel,
the character.
Wheelbarrow. Yeah.
Yeah. It's everything we do is sort of self-reflexive, and it has this, you know, love of movies while taking the piss out of them all at the same time. And we feel like if we can, you just go back and look at Community Arrested, what we did on Community Arrested Development. If we can tell a story that entertains the audience that wants to be there for an action film, but also then tell a story, you know, that, that has a certain level of wit to it, for people who like to deconstruct movies, then we feel like we win.
And then finally, you're on your own here this
yeah.
week, and you write the Extraction movies on your own as
That's
well.
Right.
You mentioned the Coen brothers earlier on. I mean, you know, Joel made the tragedy of Macbeth on his own.
That's right.
This isn't the precursor of a Russo brothers split, is it, Joe?
It is not. Although I got to tell you that that Ethan's review of Beth was brilliant and scathing.
Scathing. Finally nailed Joel Cohen to the mast.
No, I think, you know, over the years, you know, even though we're a duo, we always look at it from the perspective that we can get a lot more work done because there's two of us. So we have a real divide and conquer mentality. And you do it for so long together that you're going to come up with the same answer. So it's like, why put our energy into the same space at the same time when it can be in different places, giving the same answer to different people. You know?
So Anthony's doing another interview right
That's
now.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Joe, I presume credit card debt is all paid now. You're good.
Yeah, it has been paid off. I think somewhere around 2009, it got paid off.
Must've been hell of a feeling.
Getting rid of those student loan debts.
it's a hell of a thing. Joe Russo, always a pleasure.
Great to see you, man.
Thank you. Take care. And that was Joe Russo, sadly confirming that there isn't a character called Keith Dildo in Extraction 2, which feels a bit like a missed opportunity for me. But that is it for this Empire Podcast interview special. I hope you guys enjoyed it. As I said earlier, if you want even more from Joe Russo and his brother Anthony, pick up the new issue of Empire, now on sale in all good, evil and virtual newsagents, and read all about how they made The Grey Man. It's good stuff, even if I do say so myself. If you want more Empire Podcast, there's a new episode out every Friday. And if you want more Russos talking about their films, sign up to our spoiler special podcasts where we have in-depth interviews with them about Captain America the Winter Soldier, Captain America Civil War, and Avengers Endgame. No Infinity War, you may notice. We didn't quite make that happen at the time. Perhaps we'll fix that one day. And if you want more information about the Sands Film Festival at St. Andrews, go to sands-iff.com. That's sands-iff.com. IFF.com. This year's inaugural edition was a big success, so fingers crossed that it becomes a regular thing. Right, that's enough for me. I'm off to have a tonics before hitting a few balls at my local driving range. Trying to fix my swing, I'm slicing quite a lot. Not quite sure what to do. Any advice would be gratefully accepted. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. See you next time. Bye.